few months ago, Michael Jackson's program, 6:30 in the morning, we were out in Elsinore, and I was told that the program would appear 6:30 in the morning, and I went and looked at myself, I was shocked. You know, you get the reverse reflection.
Anyway, last time when we left off, we were talking about your joining the Communist Party and becoming really involved, becoming a full-timer, and how you started traveling and living with the party rather than your family. And I guess where I want to go from here is to talk about some of the things that especially stand out in your mind from your early days, like when in your 20s, in the Communist Party, the things that happened, if you met Angelo or if you met any...
Much later.
Okay, well, then let's just start with what you were doing then.
Is it on?
Yeah.
The earliest recollections of that period that I think would be of some value comes about a time when I was sent out by the Communist Party to become an organizer of young people in outlying areas around Chicago, such as Milwaukee, Gary. They were all part of the Chicago district, as we call it, district of political influence. And in these areas, it was really barren, politically speaking. You came in and you found a handful of people who had been reading socialist literature and already had some connections with the communist movement, because the movement was very young. The party was born in 1919 and really solidified itself as a political organization in 1921. So by the time I got there, around 26, 27, there were already nuclei of people, young, set up in a separate organization and the older in a Communist Party grouping. And I was sent out as a young Communist League organizer. Well, I had great handicaps, naturally. I wasn't well-versed in the language, and I was still a foreigner because we had just arrived in this country in 22. I was too young to go in as an organizer. I didn't know the political infighting and innuendos and connotations of the political struggle. But you go in with that zeal and that revolutionary enthusiasm because I have just discovered socialism, Marxism, and it was the greatest thing in my life, as it is to everyone I have ever talked to who first discovers it. And for many of us, it remains through life, as it has remained with me. The most inspiring influence in life is the understanding of the Marxian interpretation of society, of the world we live in, and the extension of Marxism to modern times becomes a real challenge to any probing mind, because many things that I did or said in 1927-28, I would not say in 78, obviously, because 50 years later, there has taken place such a fundamental reshuffle of the relationships of people to society and the influence of society upon the people that we draw different conclusions. And those who stand still and still keep interpreting the world as we did in the late 20s are the ones who become sects or cults or little groupings or people who become isolated from the mainstream of American life. But at that time, this was a little bit of my own philosophy. Since we were expelled from the Communist Party in 1974, I had to get the record straight with you on that. So now you know I'm not speaking as a Communist Party person, but I'm speaking as a Marxist who firmly believes that society will eventually have to be completely changed so that the producers of society will benefit from their labor. That goes for the workers, the intellectuals, the middle class, the professionals will all be able to fully benefit from their efforts. But at that time, the big thing that appeared to me as a necessity for accomplishment in order to gain my own stature with the other people and to become important to myself was to go out and organize young people into the Young Communist League. And that is not a very simple thing at a time when the country is enjoying so-called prosperity, as we did in 1927, 28, up to 29, and people wouldn't listen very much to the interpretations we were giving, except that we were able, I was able, together with my comrades and friends, to explain that recognition of the Soviet Union, the first socialist state in the world, recognition that is legal, formal recognition, by diplomatic recognition by the United States, and trading with the Soviet Union is of mutual benefit to the two countries. And so I was able to speak at many factories and organizations that have been in existence, who were bored with life and who would invite me to come and speak. Mm-hmm. And then we would on occasion pick up the real grievances of the young people. There was bad conditions at that time, discrimination at that time against the black people. We harped on those questions and we were able to gather around ourselves supporters, followers from whom we recruited, and I built a Young Communist League in Milwaukee, and later when I came back to Chicago they sent me to other places, and the same process.
Did you feel that you ever had problems within the YCL or the CP being young and a woman, that people would say, oh, we don't want to give you this responsibility, or that they would underestimate you, or that you felt like you had to hold on for dear life, or, you know?
I cannot say that I felt that when I was a youngster of 17, 18, 19 years of age. Mm-hmm. I felt that as I began to mature as a political worker, and as I grew up, my fight within the party was always of the nature of fighting against male supremacist activities, behavior, where if you will still be able to use that term, giving me the shit work and somebody getting the political credit for my accomplishments. On occasion, because I was sort of theoretically inclined, I liked to read theoretical material, I would on occasionally write an article or express my criticism of something that would get published. But generally speaking, I would say that later, during my growing up the years, I didn't like the idea that a man would get himself elected to some kind of a leadership committee, and I would still remain unrecognized, even though I was showing greater capacity for organizing the people, for speaking, for writing. But I cannot say that I felt it very keenly, very acutely. We were too much engrossed in understanding the society around us and in building the organization. There were factional fights within, but they were not around questions of discrimination against women or discrimination against minority people, because actually the Young Communist League and the Communist Party at that time were undoubtedly champions of the rights for minorities and oppressed peoples. So that was not a problem of any concern to me. You've got to come up with other questions.
No, I think that's interesting. When you were traveling from area to area trying to organize, would you stay at comrades' homes or in motels or camp out, or how would you live?
We lived very modestly. This is one of the things that has remained with me as a style of living, which in my opinion I appreciate very deeply. And that is, we never looked for personal, what you would say, aggrandizement, personal enrichment. I would have a little suitcase, and within it were all my belongings. a couple of changes of underwear, a change of a pair of shoes, some stockings, and maybe two blouses and a skirt, and then if I was wearing a jacket or a coat, that was sufficient. And the travel was 99% of the time hitchhiking. Hitchhiking at that time was not a dangerous avocation. Neither was it a highly respectable in the sense that you would get a little bit of razzing and ridicule, mm-hmm. Ridiculing by those who would pick you up. But there was never the problem of being in danger. By way of example on how times have changed on that score, I remember at one time I was elected a delegate to a national convention of the Young Communist League, which was held in New York City. And here I am located in the Gary, Chicago community. How to get from this place to the other was an important problem because we never had money. And it was all false that we were existing on Moscow gold. Mm-hmm. We were existing on the collections and the dues payments and other incomes from affairs that we would be running. I don't mean personal affairs, I mean social events. So I hiked to the New York Convention by myself, somehow couldn't hook up with the others, and here I managed to get to the Allegheny Mountains, at the foot of the mountains, when it was dark. We never had enough money to stay overnight. There were no motels. It was either a hotel or you knock on some private home's door and you ask if they can put you up for the night. But I decided I was going to cross the Alleghenies during the night so I could get to the convention for the opening. And it never occurred to me that it was dangerous to stand there and hitchhike a ride. So I waited and waited, and eventually a car with four young boys came by. I was young myself, and I was not flirtatious, or in those days we used to say a clairvoyant type, meaning a flirt. But I was fairly good-looking and clean in my appearance, and no doubt impressed anyone as being a decent kind of a girl. So when they let me into the car, it was an open car, and we were climbing over the mountains, and it's a cold night, and it was a most beautiful experience to see how these boys were vying for the opportunity to use their jackets to cover me up, to protect me during the night. Mm-hmm. And when we finally got over the mountains, and came down to a restaurant, they were again trying to treat me with all the food I could take, but since we're modest in all respects, I was modest in my eating habits too, so most likely it was a glass of milk and a donut for breakfast. And then they had to continue in another direction, and I continued hiking in, and I got in time for my convention. It was more or less that kind of experience I've had in hiking all over the Midwest, from the Midwest to the East Coast. I never hiked any farther from there than to Kansas City, which is the heart of the United States. In later years, I drove across the country, also with hitchhikers. I wasn't hitchhiking. I was driving with two young fellows who advertised, and they turned out to be very adorable young men going to the West Coast. And we took on hitchhikers. We were only three. We could take five. And there I realized that the plight of some of the hitchhikers was even worse than mine. You know, they really were literally without a cent to their name. I always had a little bit of change of some money to get from city to city. But in each city that I came to, I always had a connection, and people would pick me up for the night, mm-hmm. would give me food. And somehow, being so young and in very exceptionally good health, the matter of comfort and food was really never of serious concern to me.
Did you have any, even with the little money that you had, was there anything that you ever really liked to indulge yourself in matter of clothes or books or...
There was very much
candy or
very much a story in this relation that would interest you is because I was deprived of a normal education, and I had to make up, like when I was 19, 20, 22, I had to make up in my reading what I should have had in my younger days. And then because I became so quickly involved in the political dialogues and life not only of this country but internationally, there were so many magazines that came out and books and new novels and so on. I was extremely anxious to keep up with it, and I was not sexually too much developed to have the need for male company. So whatever free time I had until I was about 25 or 28, before I started going out with men, I spent my time reading and studying, and with dictionaries in my hands, always a little dictionary, pocket dictionary, big dictionary, so that I forever was reading and studying. And I discovered that I could not satisfy my appetite on the allotment that a young communist league made to me. So the one episode I would relate to you, which was very interesting to me, was there was a bookstore run and owned by the Communist Party of Chicago at 2024 West Division Street. And upstairs of the bookstore was the headquarters of the Communist Party, and in another section, the Young Communist League. So it was natural for us to be patronizing the bookstore, and guests and visitors from out of town would be there. Well, I came down to the bookstore whenever I was in Chicago, and I was just hungry and thirsty for that material. I had some big shopping bag, or I forget it. No, it was a big, I had a shoulder strap, big purse, because I used it at times for also carrying a change of underwear or stockings or a pair of night slippers or something like that. And I used to come in and load up with things that caught my eye, especially there was a magazine called Improcor, International Press Correspondence. Mm-hmm. It was an onion-skin paper, thin paper, and it consisted of international studies of developments throughout the world, and that was my need. So I would take the current issues and a novel and other material. And the owner of the place, or the one in charge, his name was Samuel Hammersmark. Incidentally, I remember all that because I had to research not too long ago for one of my books, so mm-hmm. the whole thing is still fresh in my mind. He would pretend that he didn't see me do what I did. He was so knowledgeable about the desires of young people to study and read that he would look the other way and let him take things. But then when I would get paid, I would come in, because as soon as I left the store, I would go to the rear someplace and mark down what I stole on that particular day. And I would come in about a month later from Gary or from Milwaukee, wherever I happened to be. And I would say, Sam, I owe you money. And he would play a little game with me and say, you owe me money. I should pay you money. Why won't you pay me money? And, you know, he was an elderly gentleman from Denmark or someplace. And very, very wonderful person. And I would take out maybe $2.50, $3.40, $1.69, something like that, in payment for. And he would act amazed. But then we would go through the same routine maybe 2-3 times until I had to leave for a larger city, where I began all over again to take literature in such fashion and then repay. To me, it was a principle to repay. I tried very much to avoid the habit of stealing and acting smart-alecky and being successful in stealing from our own bookstores material, because once at that time, I somehow developed these high moral levels of morality that were very significant to me, very important, because I felt if you steal from one of these, then you will steal from your comrades, then you will steal from whoever else you will be with, and I just didn't do it. That was the one thing I can remember. Another thing I remember was there was a dress on Michigan Boulevard in one of the windows that was my dream dress. It was, I can describe it to the minutest detail if you're interested.
Please do.
It was a blue, navy blue, not navy blue, sky blue silk dress that had a shirring on the top, which was enabled me to hide my bust line, because I was always modest in exposing my body. And it had three-quarter length sleeves that helped to hide what I thought was a bony elbow. I was very self-conscious about that. A beautiful little white bone buckle over a belt that was on the waistline, and it also had inset pockets, which meant you could keep a lot of your belongings.
Was it a full skirt?
It was a full skirt, but not very full. It was below the knees. I could tell all that from the many, many stops I made in front of that window. And once I was brave enough to go in and ask how much it was, and they told me it was $17. That amounted to more than a month's salary that I would be getting off and on in New York. So it was obviously out of reach for me. However, there's a happy ending to that. When I was assigned to work in Gary some years later, I was getting my food free and my rent free, but I was still collecting something like $8 a week for my expenses. And so I was able to put aside money, and much late, oh, perhaps 6, 8 weeks later, or 3 months later, I went to that same Michigan Boulevard store and asked them if they by chance had the dress that used to be on display. And sure enough, they had it in stock, and I tried it on, and it fitted me beautifully. And I had accumulated enough money to buy the dress. So therefore, I was one of the richest young women, in my judgment, to be able to wear a $17 blue silk dress. I didn't wear it, of course, every day, but I had so many appearances to make, you know, speaking engagements. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't wear it on picket lines or when I gave out distributing leaflets. But it was one of my very beautiful collections, which I later remodeled and made a skirt and a separate blouse from it, because I took an interest in sewing years later and remodeling whatever old schmatas I had. And this thing was too precious to leave alone or give away. And so I made like two outfits of it, a skirt and a blouse, separated. And then I was able to buy a blouse for it, and I wore the blouse that I made with the top with another skirt. So to the very end, I had two outfits for my $17 blue silk gown.
Well, with all your pretty clothes, how did... were you ever asked out for a date by a young man?
And
you didn't want to, how would you refuse something like that?
Well, I have some recollections of riding in a car with one young fellow who I was at that time still not yet dating people. Mm-hmm. And I remember he was driving me to a meeting, and it was very cold. And he asked me to move up close to him, which I did, not realizing that that was part of his plan. Mm-hmm. And when I came a little closer, I could see that his behavior was more than a comradely attitude of protecting me from the cold. So that was my first awakening to the fact that I'm riding with a man who was interested in me. Mm-hmm. As a young girl. The second time was there was a young fellow whose name I cannot reveal because he's still around, and he never knew that I really fell for him. And he paid absolutely no attention to me. Mm-hmm. He was just as busy with his political work as I was, and he became a very important leader in the party, and the party later sent him overseas to study and to travel. And I was a little bit brokenhearted over the fact that he didn't at all notice my existence. So, okay, but then later there was a young man who was extremely popular with the girls, and I had a tendency to go just for the popular fellows, the handsome guys, I imagine like a lot of young girls. And this fellow, there was a mutual attraction, and I had no problems with him. We agreed wherever he wanted to go, I would go wherever I wanted to go, he would go. He was an organizer for one of the unions. He had a little bit more pay than I. And so I could say that he was among those who made me realize that I was desirable. And that didn't last because he took up with me off and on like that only because he was playing a game with a steady girl. And I knew his steady girl, a very beautiful young woman who was like a middle-class woman. I was really a roughneck, you know, a little tomboyish and not paying too much attention about my looks or clothes too much. I was completely absorbed in my political work. And here she was almost the opposite of me. I think if I remember accurately, she was either a social worker or in that field of work. So she was well-dressed and well-groomed and had an income. And she was her study girl, and they must have fallen out of it. There must have been some problem there. And so I remember one of my mentors, one of my older women comrades, who would always say, why didn't you go after this one? Why didn't you go after that one? Ethel, it's about time you started looking out for yourself as far as these men are concerned. And I'd say, oh, don't bother me. But with this young fella, she like gave me instructions what I should do. She loaned me her lipstick. I never cared to use lipstick. I didn't know how to put it on. And I could never use creams or powders on my face. That was just too annoying. But lipstick I would use, especially when I would see him come around. And she was so proud that she was successful in bringing him and me together. He played a guitar. He had a very lovely, charming, romantic voice.
What were her instructions on how to attract young men?
They really weren't in such details as more or less reminding me that she was very successful with men. You see, Ethel, it's not that you just don't sit around and wait until someone will come and make a declaration of love to you. You have to go out with someone. Now, she was the one I admired politically and otherwise, and she was living with a man, not married, and had a daughter with him. And she was quite happy with the daughter, but then he left her, the husband, her lover. And but it was before he left away, she had a child, and she was so happy with her child, that she called my attention to the fact that you have to be somewhat aggressive, that some of these men, something that's coming up now 50 years later that you read about, that if you're interested in someone, and since you believe in equality in every respect, try to make yourself noticeable when this so-and-so comes around in some way. Well, you try, you succeed. So I tried, and it wasn't difficult. And I would appreciate if we got off that subject because these are not my most, of course, you got to follow your outline, but I am much more inclined to talk about political developments and relationships within the political movement or the developments between the white and black people and stuff like that because my personal life was a self-abnegating type of life. You are not self-indulgent. You simply have to, you work. You're in the movement. You're a soldier of the revolution. And so these personal incidents I'm citing to you are really rare. Only later, much later, when I was 43 years of age, I got married to Angelo. Mm-hmm. Although we met some 4 years before that, and we waited for each other while I was in a so-called underground, hiding from the McCarthy hooligans in this country, you know. And 4 years later, when I came out, I was 43, and we then got married, you know.
Okay, well, let me just ask you one last thing about this. If women your age who went out on dates, where would one go if you were a Communist Party member? And would you go to the movies, or would you go out to the park? Or
yes, we went to the movies. I have a recollection of another person than this man who picked me up primarily because he had trouble with his middle-class white girl. Mm-hmm. There was an exceptionally handsome and attractive young black fellow, mm-hmm, who to me was personified beauty as I understood it in human development. And it seemed that he had noticed me too. And through a black family whom I had befriended and with whom I worked politically, I was told by the man with whom I worked politically that mm-hmm so-and-so is very much interested in me. I said, gee, that's wonderful. I like him too. Mm-hmm. Okay. So after some kind of, I don't remember the preliminaries, we decided to, that is already in the early 30s, mm-hmm, where discrimination and all that is still very deep-rooted.
Yes.
We met at the Wicker Theater, because this was such a big event in my life. I remember on Randolph Street, we saw a movie, and then we went to a hotel on the south side. And the woman who opened the door to us and let us in definitely looked upon me as a kind of prostitute, because it was at that time unknown for a black and white to go to the south side, which was sort of run down, but it was a room. And I remember I was terribly embarrassed over the whole thing, but it was a big event in my life. So he went and he bought the Sunday paper, which was a big Chicago Tribune, and I was sitting and reading before we were able to get together for the night, you know. So people did then what you're doing today. If they were advanced in their thinking, and if the prejudices were low or non-existent, although I doubt any white person is free of prejudice against color, mm-hmm, black. But I had a big advantage in that I came from a country or from Europe where this was at the minimum level. So my prejudices were not embedded deeply as a result of American upbringing.
Didn't you think it was sort of outrageous for him to get a hotel room for both of you?
Not at all. On the contrary, it was a tremendous accomplishment that he was able, it wasn't a hotel room, it was a rooming house, mm-hmm, which had quite a number of others, I assume. Mm-hmm. But when we came, he had that already arranged. I thought it was just a wonderful thing, instead of us walking the streets, holding hands, and looking for a place where to go and spend the night. When he knew that I was his date for that Saturday night, that I consented to meet him, and I came all dressed, and he was dressed to kill. I think, if I, my memory is correct, he wore a derby, which was the height of dress, you know. And I was wearing very good clothes, whatever I had, I don't remember at the moment. But I thought it was very thoughtful of him, very considerate. He took care of me in the sense that he wouldn't have me paraded around on the south side as his date. But after the show, we took a streetcar and we went. And then how I got back, I remember
But if he got a hotel room, it wasn't so that he could sleep with you.
It was not a hotel. It was a rooming house. And he evidently knew that in this rooming house, you can rent a room. And maybe he had lived there before, mm-hmm, with other women, or maybe he had used that room that way before. I couldn't at that time look into that detail, and I'm even less interested in it now. All I know is that I was favorably impressed with the fact that I wasn't exposed to the searching looks that people would give me on the streetcar, which they did, and when we got off, they did, and when we walked to the place, even though it was kind of late, but people were out on the street. I remember that there was great relief when we got to the place and we had a place for ourselves for the night. So that was I was very grateful for that. But the woman who opened the door, I don't remember her appearance or anything, but I have an impression that she looked down upon me very strongly as a riffraff, a streetwalker, and that you might have just picked me up on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I never since saw him again. I never had anything in common with him again, because he was mentally or politically not at all interested in my kind of work. And after maybe one more date or something, it was a meaningless experience otherwise. I mean, it was not a sustained kind of a relationship. However, years later, not so many years later, maybe 2-3 years later, I was sent out to Buffalo, New York. And there I developed a very serious love affair with a black man who was the leader in the Communist Party. And I was like his assistant for the young communist student. And we worked together very closely. And I became his girlfriend, and for a long time I looked upon him as my husband. And then later when I discovered that he had a lady friend and even had a child by her, which was a very great tragedy, and many years later he turned out to be a stool pigeon for the American government in the communist movement, and he was the one who testified against me.
Oh.
All the way in Los Angeles, California, when I was arrested on a deportation order in 1952. In other words, 20 years later, I had seen him in between once or twice. He wasn't exposed as a FBI agent for a long time. He has died since. His name can be mentioned.
Was there, obviously at this time in the 30s, 40s, 50s, a woman's virginity before she got married was a very important thing, you know, people's families are concerned about and so on. Would you say there were the same kind of morality within the Communist Party, or was it if you were a Communist Party member, you could have sexual relations with who you pleased and no one was going to treat you bad because you weren't married or because you weren't living with someone?
Well, the question could be answered only by telling you that those of us who were in the communist movement as officers, as officials, as workers of the movement,
mm-hmm.
fully dedicated to it, led an entirely different life from the general public. I, at the moment, would feel that the general public had great respect for the girl who didn't go to sleep with anyone until she got married.
Mm-hmm.
But within the communist movement, I would not say that there was promiscuity, or that there might have been, but I wouldn't be witness to it because of my own rigidity mm-hmm. towards the question of men and so on. I frequently saw changing of partners and people going away together, and we never verbalized it, never talked about it, but I would say that there was a much freer relationship, sexual relationship, physical, personal relationship between the men and women, which also led to extremely deep friendships and dedications, and you could see couples traveling out of their area to cities hundreds of miles away. To do Communist Party work, they would do it together, and they would later even raise families, and later they would get married. We had that. Or they might be married and travel together. So I would, I'm not trying to cover up for the Communist Party and Communist League. I know that there existed a good amount of free relationship between the men and women, but I could never at any point feel that it was a promiscuous type of a relationship. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, I feel that the morality on the outside was of a very rigid type, looking upon a woman as one who must wait for the holy night when she, after she has a little piece of paper to go to sleep, even though the man was known as one who had been running around.
What did you or other women use as birth control?
Well, there was the men would use the condoms.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what you call it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only means I had known until I got married. Most likely because I didn't have time or money or interest to get better adjusted with some other means.
Mm-hmm.
I always left it to the man with whomever I had relations to take care of that problem. That's what it was.
Was that something that was on your mind a lot? Did you always make sure?
Not particularly. Generally you're touching on a subject that was so secondary in my makeup and my life and even in my memory now that it wasn't of a great concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. I think I'm going to turn the tape over and we'll move on to something else.